Invite Tim Grobart to come up to the podium to talk about somatic mutations in MDS, insights into their prognostic and biological importance. Tim.
And I'd like to thank you all for coming out to this early morning session at ASH. So I need to mention first that over the last year I've done some consulting for a company that does genetic testing. Reassure you that it really has absolutely nothing to do with what I'm going to talk about today. So this disease we're talking about today, as you all know, our patients die, can be split essentially into these two categories, about a third dying after they transform to secondary leukemia and the others dying as a consequence of bone marrow failure and transfusional iron overload. But the main thing I wanted to point to in this slide is this number down here, this broad range of the incidence of the disease in the U.S., and it troubles me that we don't know exactly how common this disease is. We know exactly how many patients with acute leukemia and other chronic leukemias are diagnosed each year in our countries, but there's great uncertainty about the incidence of the disease. It probably falls somewhere in this range, maybe even higher. And this has been written about and discussed quite a bit recently, and the thinking is that this is related in part to an under-ascertainment or just uncertainty in the diagnosis, which I think to some extent reflects still our incomplete understanding of the pathophysiology. And as we, particularly in the area of genetics, learn more about the disease, hopefully there'll be greater diagnostic certainty and we'll have actually a better idea of how common this disease is. So I like to show this slide that my friend David Steensma shared with me that summarizes the enormous international longstanding effort that's been made in this field to provide better and better classification diagnostic prognostic models for this disease up into the most recent model published in Blood this year, as Dr. Nimer mentioned. But the point I want to emphasize is that, of course, the more recent models all include cytogenetics, but till now there are no molecular gene mutations that are incorporated into any of these prognostic models. And so, again, for example, the most recent model, the IPSS-R, although it does a fantastic job of stratifying patients into different risk groups, five of them, it still utilizes relatively simple tools to perform this scoring and stratification. Of course, this is can be looked at as a virtue, as a strength of the system. That these are readily available, inexpensive parameters that we should be collecting on all of our patients, but do not incorporate genetic mutations. And as we all know, despite the stratification, there's still a lot of heterogeneity here. We have patients, even in the most favorable risk groups, dying prematurely. And so there's presumably some hidden heterogeneity in here, perhaps accounted for to some extent by genetic heterogeneity, that could be used to improve these models. And so this is why, for me, the paper published last year in the New England Journal by Rafe Bahar and Ben Eber and colleagues at the Brigham and Women's Hospital really was seminal. As you know, the study looked at a large number of genes in a large cohort of patients, identified a number of genes that had recurrent somatic mutations, and five of them highlighted here had independent, all adverse prognostic value when all the other covariates, the relevant ones, were incorporated into the model. And so at every stage, this is using the IPSS system, every stage except for the high-risk patients, the presence of a mutation, one of these recurrent mutations, upstaged patients from a lower risk group to a higher risk group. Again, providing some evidence that genetic heterogeneity to some extent may account for some of the remaining clinical heterogeneity in our prognostic models. This heat map summarizes these recurrent gene mutations identified in that study. And I'm going to show a couple of these, and I'm sure over the course of this meeting we'll be seeing a lot of these types of heat maps. I think the format is probably familiar to all of you. Each patient is represented in a column and the recurrently mutated genes in rows. And you get a lot of information just by glancing at these including the frequency of recurrent mutations, the co-occurrence of mutations, for example, in P53 and complex cytogenetics, or co-occurrence or mutual exclusive mutations, such as these examples. So, again, in this study, they found 18 genes that were recurrently mutated, five of which listed here, again, had independent prognostic value. And at this stage, this paper published just about a year and a half ago, there was at least one of these mutations in just over half of the patients in this cohort. But as you know, there's really been a pretty dramatic explosion of our understanding of the genetics of this disease in just a short period of time, really since this paper was published. And as you'll see, we can do better than this now, better than finding just a mutation in half of our patients. So, for example, the same group, together with colleagues at the MD Anderson, published in JCO this year, similar type of analysis focusing on patients with low-risk MDS. Again, a heat map showing the recurrently mutated genes, now including some of the more recently identified genes here. And they first were able to validate the MD Anderson low-risk prognostic scoring system. But again, looking at these recurrently mutated genes, now greater than 70% of patients in low-risk MDS have at least one mutation in this category. And in this analysis, only EZH2 mutations had independent prognostic value. So this kind of work really, I think, sets the stage for what I want to talk about. We're living in an age still in the phase of discovery genomics in MDS. I feel that we do not yet know all the recurrently mutated genes, but this type of analysis in an iterative fashion will need to be performed in the next few years to identify these patterns of co-occurrence exclusivity and which genes have prognostic value. So what I want to talk about for most of the time today is not every gene that's been reported in the last several years, but to try to tie them together in a number of biologically coherent stories. And the first one is probably the most exciting to us in the field, is the fact that genes encoding factors important for RNA splicing, we now know are highly recurrently mutated in myeloid leukemias, especially MDS. And still the most comprehensive study was the first published in this field by Dr. Ogawa's group in Japan, showing eight of these RNA splicing factor genes recurrently mutated in MDS and, again, in other myeloid malignancies. And, again, a strikingly mutually exclusive pattern. Patients tend not to have more than one mutation in this pathway, either because it's not necessary or perhaps it's not tolerated in a cell to acquire two mutations, two hits in this pathway. Again, at least one mutation in half of our MDS patients. So I'm going to focus on these three of the most highly recurrently mutated splicing genes and talk a little bit about mutation spectrum and what little we know so far about clinical associations and biology. So beginning with the SF3B1 story, published again in the Ogawa study, as well as in this paper in the New England Journal from the International Cancer Genome Consortium. This figure from their paper shows this splicing factor, SF3B1, and the location of mutations across the gene. These are all heterozygous missense mutations. I believe all the mutations have been reported in this gene by this group and others fall into this category. And you can see a hot spot where about half of the mutations clustered a single codon here, position 700. As I imagine you know, there's a striking association between the presence of this mutation in MDS patients who have ring sideroblasts, either RARS, RCMDRS, or RARST. And so the presence of a mutation has a very strong positive predictive value for the presence of ring sideroblasts in this disease. The first example, we have really a very strong genotype-phenotype correlation in this disease. And again, as I imagine you know, after the initial descriptions in MDS, quickly thereafter, mutations in this gene were identified in other leukemias, particularly CLL, as well as other myeloid malignancies, and now a number of solid tumors, although at a much lower frequency than in MDS. So in MDS patients in general, the presence of these mutations have strong positive prognostic value, as shown in the initial report here and a follow-up study from this group. But much of this positive prognostic value can be attributed to, again, the strong association between this mutation and MDS with RS, which, as you know, is an entity that has a favorable prognosis. And so in a number of publications subsequently looking just at patients with RIRS or another way controlling for IPSS or WHO category, most of the positive prognostic value disappears, although I should say this still is somewhat controversial. In some studies controlling for WHO category or WPSS group, there still is a positive survival benefit to the presence of the mutation. But in my reading of the literature, really, I think most of the positive impact on survival is captured by this tight association between SF3B1 mutations and ring sideroblasts. So what about the biology? So certainly reasonable to speculate that recurrent mutations in genes that are important for RNA splicing contribute to MDS in some way altering splicing. And in fact, we do have some data to suggest that that may be true. This is a figure from the CLL paper in the New England Journal showing that in CLL patient samples, two genes known to undergo alternative splicing showed increased evidence of alternatively spliced transcripts in patients who had the SF3B1 mutation compared to those with their wild type. And then in a blood paper published this year from the Cleveland Clinic group, a transcriptome analysis in a small number of patients showed a number of exons that were differentially spliced or expressed in patients with SF3B1 mutations, including alternative splicing of a number of genes important for leukemogenesis. Although I would say that really we are still in the early days of understanding the consequence of these mutations on splicing and to what extent that's really relevant for the pathophysiology of the disease. Turning to another member of this family, the U2AF1 protein that binds the AG dinucleotide at the 3' end of almost all of our introns. We identified recurrent mutations in this protein by whole genome sequencing of a number of MDS patients and then sequencing the exons in 150 patients. And in our study found mutations only in these two codons, codon 34 and codon 157, in two regions predicted to be zinc fingers in this protein, very highly conserved residues you can see here. And virtually all the mutations now that have been reported in this gene by others really are restricted to these two codons with rare exceptions and are, again, all heterozygous missense substitutions. Frequency is really very close to this number. That's been pretty consistent. And by deep sequencing of our patients with these mutations, we show that they appear to be acquired early in the pathogenesis of the disease, or present at a high mutant allele burden in the founding clone, and the mutant allele is expressed at similar levels to the wild type. Again, what about the biological consequences? Looking first at splicing, does this mutation alter splicing? And again, there's some evidence that that's the case. Again, a candidate gene, not a gene that we think is necessarily at all relevant for the biology of this disease, just a gene that we know is alternatively spliced, FMR1. In tissue culture cells, the presence of the mutant allele, again, leads to increased abundance of these alternatively spliced products. And we see that as well for the same gene in primary MDS samples that have the mutant allele compared to the wild-type allele. And also now from RNA-seq analysis of normal 34 positive cells from cord blood transduced with the mutant allele, again, increased abundance of alternative splicing of this particular candidate gene. And then finally, on splicing, I'll just touch on SRSF2, a gene that, again, in the Ogawa paper was initially shown to be highly associated with patients with CMML in particular. In this large study from the Munich group published in Blood this year looking just at CMML, found mutations in this factor in nearly half of these patients with mutations clustering at this hotspot in codon 95 in a linker region, mostly missense substitutions, but in this paper to some extent other small insertion or deletion events, again affecting this codon 95 hotspot, all predicted to be deleterious for the function of the protein. But still, I think, as I said, we're in early days and we're still exploring the model, providing a number of publications, including this one from Ben Ebert and Olivier Bernard, showing the spliceosome here and the eight factors that we know are recurrently mutated, shown in red, and potential alternative fates of transcripts here, including retained introns or skipped exons or cryptic splice site utilization that may be, to some extent, altered the abundance of these factors by splicing gene mutations. But the connection to MDS phenotype, the physiology of the disease, is still, I would say, not very well understood at this point. But this theme will be taken up in earnest at this meeting. Lots of work. This is an incomplete list of talks that and presentations that are available, including description of new alleles in novel splicing factors, some genetically engineered transgenic mice models, early exploration of preclinical testing of targeted compounds, and then additional work on the impact of these mutations on the biology of the disease and clinical associations. So if you're interested in splicing, there's lots to look forward to in the next couple of days. So I wanted to turn to a couple of other themes, again, that we've learned from genetics recently. Beginning here, I won't dwell on this. This is a figure from the education program last year, where at this point, this was probably the pathway that we understood best in this disease in terms of recurrent mutations falling into a particular biological pathway. This depicts the factors that are regulators are important for regulation of the epigenome, including DNA methylation and demethylation, or hydroxymethylation, and histone methylation that are, again, themselves targets of somatic mutations in MDS and other myeloid malignancies, shown in the colored circles here. And we've learned this year from mouse models of these factors some of the functional consequences of these mutations. We'll hear at the meeting for the first time a description of a mouse model, a conditional mouse allele for this gene, and its MDS phenotype. So again, another area of active investigation that I just don't have time to talk about more this morning. I want to talk about another theme that's emerging in this field. It's been alluded to already. This complex of proteins called the cohesins that mediate sister chromatid cohesion during mitosis may also have a role in regulating transcription. Recently, a number of the factors shown here with the asterisks have been shown to be somatically mutated in patients with AML. In some of these papers here, and then again at the meeting this week, we'll hear about description consequences of mutations in a number of these factors in patients with MDS in several talks. So stay tuned for that. And then in terms of mutation discovery, again, I said early on, we're still in this discovery phase. We've not identified all the recurrently mutated genes in this disease. And I'm showing you some preliminary data from a study that's not yet complete of mutational profiling of about 100 genes and 150 patients at our center. And again, I think you'll see heat maps like this at the meeting with novel gene mutations described. And again, now this sliver of the pie here, patients without a recurrent gene mutation or cytogenetic abnormality, getting ever smaller. In our study, fewer than 15%. Of patients had neither. So we're getting close to the point where in nearly all of our patients we can identify recurrent either gene mutations or cytogenetic abnormalities, which is exciting, I think. So on that theme, novel recurrently mutated mutations, again, we'll hear important high-profile talks at this meeting, including description of mutations in this gene at the plenary session and in one of the late-breaking abstracts. Other large panels of deep sequencing novel mutations, again, at the late-breaking session and other genes as well. So lots of new information to digest, I think, at this meeting. In the last couple of minutes, I just wanted to emphasize a couple of other stories that I think we need to keep in mind that have emerged from MDS genome sequencing work in the last couple of years. And this is the first, that in most of our patients, we really are not talking about a single cancer genome present in the bone marrow of these samples, but rather in most cases, there's a mosaic of genomes that coexist within the bone marrow of our patients. And this figure comes from our paper on whole genome sequencing of a number of patients with MDS. And I'll just emphasize a couple of the points here. At the time of MDS diagnosis here, in all of our patients, we found that the portion of cells that contain these clonal mutations was very high, greater than 85% of total bone marrow cells on average, despite having low blast counts, many of these patients having myeloblast counts of less than 5%. So most of the bone marrow is part of the clonal process at MDS. And in all of our patients who progressed to secondary AML, this initial clonal population of cells, the founding clone, was always still detectable at progression to AML, but there were in all cases new clones, daughter subclones that were present in AML that were derived from this founding clone. And so I'm showing this in this context really, I think, to emphasize this point, that as we continue to identify new recurrently mutated genes, I think it will be important for us not only qualitatively to assess the presence or absence of these mutations, but to think quantitatively about which population of cells they're traveling in. And it's really speculation at this point, but I think it's likely that whether a mutation arises in a founding clone or in a daughter subclone, the same mutation, for example, may have different biological consequences, and there may be clinical consequences as well as we think about targeting some of these mutations. This is a theme that will be taken up in the context of CLL and Kathy Wu's presentation in the plenary session. And then the other story I want to emphasize is this one. This is a study we published where we did exome sequencing of hematopoietic progenitor cells from normal individuals across 7 decades of life, from cord blood to individuals in their 70s. And we found somatic mutations in these normal individuals that accumulated in a very striking age-dependent fashion. And so although models like this, I think, still are useful for us to think about, that a small number of mutations, critical number of mutations, are required to initiate a disease like MDS, and then additional mutations need to be acquired for the disease to progress. The point I think I want to make sure, and I think most people appreciate, is that as we continue to sequence exomes and genomes in these patients, first of all, most of the variants that we detect in these samples are not somatic mutations. They're inherited polymorphisms, often rare alleles, and so still essential to control these experiments by looking at matched normal samples from every individual. But after inherited variants have been eliminated, the vast majority of somatic mutations that we identify in exomes and genomes are likely to be not important biologically for the pathogenesis of the tumor, and rather are either pre-existing mutations that, again, are accumulating in an age-dependent fashion, or are background mutations that continue to accumulate. And although perhaps not biologically essential, do provide very useful genetic fingerprints to allow us to identify these founding clones and subclones and mark them and study the clonal architecture of this disease. So I'll leave you with some number of questions that are fairly straightforward, but are ones that I think many are thinking about and working out at this point. This work has begun, but I think we'll have to continue in an iterative way as we identify additional recurrent mutations. We need to figure out what really is the impact of these mutations on the prognosis of our patients, independent of other covariates, and which, if any, have predictive value for the therapies we're using today. Again, this is something we'll hear about to some extent in this meeting. There's one practical point I just want to make here. I think it's worth saying that this field is moving so rapidly that most of these mutations we identified, we don't have a test for. If we wanted to go looking for them in our patient, we really don't, in most places, have a mechanism for doing that. And so fortunately, there are large efforts in both academic labs and in commercial entities to try to make this available. But this is a technical challenge that we'll have to overcome. And again, with new mutations being reported on a regular basis, we're going to have to figure out strategies, nimble ways of updating this and making these flexible. Of course, we all want to understand the biology much better. We're really at very early days, particularly for the new mutations I discussed today. It's work. It's going to take a long time, generation of mouse models and careful laboratory studies, and we're really just at the early days for most of these mutations I talked about today. But I do think that it's not premature to begin thinking about some of these pathways that are recurrently mutated in these patients. Could they be targets for novel therapies in our patients that we need so desperately? Okay, I've tried to acknowledge many of the folks who contributed to the work I showed today. I apologize for omissions because of time constraints. I did want to thank my colleagues at Washington University who have contributed to the work that we've done, particularly the folks at our Genome Institute and individuals in our stem cell biology section led by Tim Lay, the division led by John DiPersio, and my partner in crime on MDS work, Matt Walter, who you'll hear from at this meeting. So thank you very much for your attention.